I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to this week's Your Own Personal Beatles with me, Robin Allender.
And I'm Jack Pelling.
Hello. And hello. Are you excited about today's guest?
I am, yeah. It's a really good one, this one. Recorded a few weeks ago with the brilliant comedian Nish Kumar, who is a massive Beatles fan, massive sort of 60s music fan in general. And yeah, we've been trying to get him on for a while and it sort of delivered in all the ways we hoped it would. He was brilliant.
Yeah, he was so good, so articulate, and real passion shone through. And it, yeah, it was just great to... I feel like there were some really, really interesting kind of avenues we went down. Well, obviously, there was a lot of White Album chat, as per. But we did talk about the kind of the Indian connection with the Beatles, which was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I feel guilty for slagging off the Incredible String Band. I'm so sorry if you're listening.
But it's quite a specific criticism.
Yeah, but it was very, very interesting chat. Can I do a few correction corners?
Absolutely, yeah, please do. Let's get stuck in.
One correction corner is the point where I say that George Harrison's What Is Life sounds like it's about to go into One Fine Day. I didn't mean One Fine Day. I meant Keep On Running by Jackie Edwards, as covered by the Spencer Davis Group. In fact, I've got a little clip to show you how well these two sync together, if you're mad. What I feel. One fine day I'm gonna be the one to make you understand. Oh yeah, I'm gonna be your man. We had a really good, interesting chat about Hendrix as well. Hendrix got a lot of coverage.
We don't really talk about Jimi Hendrix that much on this podcast, considering when I was young, he was probably as important to me as the Beatles.
I think Hendrix is someone where it's hard to get a grip of how incredible it sounded at the time because of the imitators that followed him in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I love Hendrix, and I don't think anyone else combined the charisma and, stage presence and musical skill as anyone since Hendrix. But you're right, for some reason, I'm the same. I think I haven't revisited it much since I was a teenager, really, and learning guitar and things.
Yeah. I tend to listen a lot more to the sort of very late stuff and Band of Gypsies and when he was sort of moving off into a kind of funky Miles Davis-y direction.
I wanted to do a correction corner, actually, about Hendrix. So I was talking about I was talking about him doing... I say he does Sunshine of Your Love and then he does a bit of Day Tripper. I got that completely wrong. On the Lulu Show, he plays Hey Joe. And in one of the little breaks, he does a little bit of I Feel Fine. And it's so effortless. Yeah. It's brilliant. And I remember trying to learn how to play Hey Jude and then do a little bit of I Feel Fine. And it took me like weeks. And then it's like, you know, he just did it off the cuff. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, if you haven't heard that BBC session with Jimi Hendrix, it's got a couple of sort of Beatles covers in there and then a few little, you know, dalliances into riffs that he's obviously got going around in his head.
Yeah,
but that, you know, it's one of the great live records.
Yeah,
of the
60s. And also, what I used to find so amazing was when he tunes his guitar halfway through. Do you remember that? So cool. But speaking of Hendrix, and which links to Woodstock, you've seen Summer of Soul, right?
I have, yeah. Mm. Yeah, I was one of those mugs that didn't realise it was coming out for free on telly this week.
Yeah.
So I went to see it about 3 days before it came out on Disney Plus.
But, oh, I see.
Yeah, it's incredible. I've been waiting for it for a long time.
It's extraordinary,
And yeah, the stuff in particular with, if you don't know what it is, it's Questlove's sort of made a documentary about the resurfaced footage from the Harlem Cultural Festival in 1969, which happened at the same time as Woodstock, but 100 miles away, but no one really... It was sort of one of those things that was kind of whitewashed from memory, and all the recordings of it just sat in a basement.
Yeah.
And the lineup is, you know, absolutely obscene.
Yeah.
It's sort of Sly Stone, Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder, anyone who's anyone you can think of. And some of the stuff in it is just mind-boggling.
The performances are extraordinary, Mavis Staples as well, just absolutely brilliant. And I think as well, because I watched it back-to-back with the documentary about Woodstock 99, which was
the
new metal.
The one that went on fire.
Yeah, the one which went on fire. And obviously made for a very interesting comparison. But I suppose what both of them made me think of is the way that Woodstock... Is the way that cultural events have such an impact on the course of history. But how, like, the Woodstock that happened in 69 was not an ideal event by any stretch of the imagination.
No.
It was pretty horror show, really. In terms of like the conditions that people had to go through.
Yeah, even from the sort of, you know, much venerated footage that's in the documentary, sometimes you look at the crowd and you're like, that looks awful.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's kind of interesting that, you know, obviously Summer of Soul was totally neglected. I mean, the Harlem Cultural Festival was totally neglected and Woodstock has taken over. And I think Woodstock 99, as well as showing you this terrible insight into kind of, it's basically like watching the internet form. Like the internet as we know now form is like in its kind of, primordial soup kind of thing of kind of social media and Twitter and just horrible men. And but it's weird that to think that, you know, 69 Woodstock wasn't that great either. So it's interesting how we're sort of subject to these historical narratives that dominate, you know.
Mm. Well, I think in general, and especially with the Beatles, there is a sort of tendency to kind of whitewash the musical world of the 60s especially. And you do think of that, you know, Mavis Staples or someone's maybe not someone who springs to mind, or just how big Stevie Wonder was in 1969 when he's only like 19 or something, you know, huge stars in the States, but because they don't sort of interweave with the kind of Beatley, you know, post-American invasion narrative, sometimes that sort of gets overlooked a bit.
Yeah, and it was such a kind of complex world of religious music, you know, soul, that still, you know, B.B. King plays there, so the blues still having an influence, and then kind of going off into funk as well. So it was such a kind of, you know, incredible point in history of all those styles coming together, and jazz and Cuban music as well. A really, really extraordinary time.
Absolutely amazing. It's out on Disney Plus right now. So, you know, not strictly Beatles, but
yeah,
it's superb. So check it out ahead of McCartney 321 or 123 or whatever it's called, which is also coming out in a couple of weeks on Disney Plus. So we'll just quickly crack on with a bit of correspondence. We've got our Patreon up and running, and thank you so much to everyone who's joined over the last week. We got one really nice email from Chris Dimitriou, who's one of our new Patreon people. And he said, I was going to contact you to say how much I've been enjoying the second series, especially the extended bonus episodes via Patreon. Thanks very much, Chris, for doing our job for us there, getting the plugs in. So you can go to patreon.com/personalbeatles if you want to hear this amazing content. Not my words, Robin, the words of Chris Dimitriou. But he says, you talking about old Beatles CD releases of the 80s and 90s brought back a long-forgotten memory. Whilst listening, I was thinking to myself, I had the White Album on CD. How could I have afforded it? And then remembered that my mum bought it for me one Christmas. You mentioned a couple of times that you're reading Mark Lewisohn's Tune In. I can heartily recommend the audiobook. Yes, all 43 hours and 40 minutes of it. I don't listen to all that many audiobooks usually because I find the reader annoying, but Clive Mantle does a really good job on Tune In. Well, both Robin and I have been listening to the audiobook of it. I have been sort of flipping back and forth between the book and the audiobook to get me through more sort of, viscous passages, shall we say.
I'm loving the audiobook.
It is really great, and I think we've sort of touched on it before, but his insistence on doing a sort of impression of every single character in the Beatles story, no matter where they come from, is quite amazing. It's worth, especially when he gets to Little Richard turning up towards the end.
Yeah. But even if it's just one word, he'll do the impression. Yeah,
yeah. But it is really great.
It's great. It really, really. It's very pacey as well for such a kind of long session.
I'm really missing it because I haven't listened to any podcasts for such a long time because I've been listening to that for the last 43 hours. But he also says, like both of you, I'm also very fond of Revolution in the Head, and the audiobook of that is very worth listening to. It uses various celeb Beatles fans as readers, including one guest from your show. Do you know who that might be?
Jeff Lloyd.
It is, yeah. Right. Good guess.
Thanks. What song does he do? Or does he do kind of...
I don't know if it's like one celeb per song, although that would be quite a heavy roster.
There'd be so many celebs.
But apparently, according to Audible, it's David Morrissey, Robin Hitchcock, Danny Baker, Peter Curran, Matt Berry.
Robin Hitchcock was on it, actually, yeah. I mean, he's such a huge Beatles fan. It'd be great to have him on, wouldn't it?
Yeah. He says, anyway, thanks very much and keep up the good work. Like the best podcasts and radio people, you come across in such a way that I now think of you as friends. Hope that doesn't sound too weird. Not at all, Chris.
That's
exactly
so
how I feel about all my favourite radio shows and podcasts and stuff. So thank you very much and thank you for joining the Patreon. That's a really nice email and hope you continue to enjoy it.
Thank you very much. And I've had a really nice message here from James Taylor. Not that one. Hello, mate. Hope you're well. Just a quick message to say how much I'm enjoying series two of your own personal Beatles. It's encouraged me to go back and go deep into some of the albums I'd previously not fully immersed myself in. I did Rubber Soul, Revolver and Abbey Road back to back yesterday, and it's prompted a to-and-fro WhatsApp conversation with my dad, born in 55, in which we just drop random deep cuts to each other and let the songs speak for themselves. Hope you're good. Keep up the good work. Which is a really nice message from James. That's great. I like the idea that it's kind of reigniting that kind of, you know, cross-generational appeal of the Beatles.
Yeah, sure. Mm. It's nice, the idea of just only communicating with a family member by deep-cut Beatles songs.
Yeah, totally.
Makes life easier.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much. And if you want to send us your personal Beatles, you can email me at jack@homespunsounds.com or go to personalbeatles.com/contact. You can follow us on all the usual social media things at Personal Beatles. And if you want to rate the show on Apple Podcasts, giving us a nice 5-star rating on that is really helpful. We've got a few nice ones this week. So, it really does help us sort of hover around the featured sections and helps like other people find the podcast. So massively appreciated if you do that, if that's how you listen. But we won't bollock on any longer. And we'll leave you with our brilliant conversation with Mr. Nish Kumar.
God, it does sound bad, doesn't it?
God, it's like doing a Bob Lemon podcast.
God, imagine if this Delta variant is so contagious that you can get it through the internet. That'd be horrible.
Surely COVID deniers could just hear that cough and realise that that is real. That's definitely a real cough.
Yeah, I mean, they're welcome to come around and hear it.
It's so weird. It's like, I also don't know how it's possible that you don't know somebody that has had it. Like, it's statistically not possible.
Yeah.
Right, that you don't know somebody that... And also, unfortunately, and this is the really grim thing, it's, like, statistically impossible for you to not know somebody that had... You know, like, that died of it. You know, even if you don't... Like, I don't know... Like, we've been very lucky in terms of no one's died of it in my family, but, like... Like, several of my friends have lost family members.
Yeah.
Like, a family friend of ours, who's one of the doctors who died of it. So I just don't... I just can't believe that there are people... I'm just like, what do you think these people died of? Like, what do you... Like, it's mad to me.
Well, there was that guy early on last year. There was a video that went viral. He sort of does a Rubik's Cube to show how smart he is at the start. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
And he was sort of saying it was like, oh, they're just, you could fall over and die. And then the doctors would say, oh, that was COVID.
I
think that's where the conspiracy line is, that it's like it's used as a catch-all for anything.
But it's crazy, right? Because like most people that die of AIDS don't, like, it isn't like the AIDS specifically that kills them, but it's like the you know, it's the fact that your body has no immune system, so most people like die of pneumonia and stuff. But like, it's absolutely, we don't, no one is like quibbling over those statistics. You know, like it's so weird.
Oh man.
It's so weird. Well, anyway, Jack, you stand a one-man riposte to the complete collapse of base level intelligence.
Yeah, I'm happy to be the poster boy for the Delta variant. So anyway, welcome to the show, brilliant comedian Mr. Nish Kumar. How are you doing, Nish?
Good, lovely to see you both.
It's lovely to see you. Thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure. How are you?
I'm well. As we were just talking about, just as a little warning, I have got COVID-19 at the moment, which means I'm quite coughy. So if I sort of go silent for a while, it probably means that I'm sort of having some sort of coughing fit. Well, and you two can just crack on.
Sure.
But, you know, don't like to bandy the word hero around. But I'll do what I can.
So, Nish, we recently heard you on the Jeff Lloyd Radio 2 programme talking about the anthology. It's kind of the 25th anniversary of the anthology. So was the in terms of the Beatles, was the anthology like a big way into the Beatles for you? How old were you when that came out?
I'm not doing any of this stuff in a contemporary sense. So like when I talk about a lot of this stuff, like I'm, you know, so the anthology came out when I was 11 years old. Right. And so I didn't have any experience of it when it came out. I do remember coming out is the anthology book. I don't know if you guys have you got that. Yeah. The enormous thing. The like A0 size.
Big silver.
Book.
Yeah. No, I haven't got it. Lusted after it. But yeah.
my friend Ollie bought a copy and I borrowed it off him because he was just like, don't buy it. I've got it. I'll read it. And so like three of us read it off by borrowing it off him. I mean, it's like reading like some like, it's like National Treasure or some shit where you find like some old, like it's like huge pages that you have to turn.
Yeah.
You feel like Moses, like this enormous, like it's almost like you have to have apparatus to like swish the page over. Yeah. But I really remember the anthology book coming out. I was into the Beatles enough that I read that cover to cover. And it is an incredible book because it's sort of the closest we will ever get to a Beatles autobiography, like an autobiography of the band. Mm. It's also one of the first things of something that's now very commonplace, which I really love. Which is sort of oral histories where the story is kind of assembled through either interviews from the period that's being written about or interviews written in the present day with people reflecting on it. I actually just read a big one about Terminator 2. Fantastic. Oh, nice. It's really good, really good.
Yeah.
And I read a whole book about the American Office that's basically in that sort of form.
Oh, yeah. There was a very good one about ATP, All Tomorrow's Party.
I just saw that. It's
very funny.
But the anthology was like one of the first times I came across that format because, you know, it would literally say Paul and then have a bit of an interview. And the interesting thing with Paul, George and Ringo is that there's a combination of archival interview and then the actual interviews that were conducted in the late 90s, early 2000s for the purposes of the TV show and the book. And then John's contributions are all taken from interviews across the period that he was alive. Between all of those things, they put together this like this really amazing book that kind of really goes deep into all of the albums. That, you know, there's just pieces of information that I have in my head that I don't need. It's of no use to anyone that I know that George Harrison played bass on Drive My Car and he modelled the bass line on the Otis Redding recording of Respect. Why do I need to know that?
Yeah.
But I don't. I do.
Yeah. I like the fact George played bass on She Said as well.
Yeah.
And that's because Paul McCartney stormed out because he didn't He didn't like the arrangement. It's so weird. It's like, great, he's a good bass player.
Yeah, very good.
That's good. I'm going to try and hunt out the book because I assumed it was just going to be like transcripts of everything that was in the documentary.
Mm. There's a good John Mitchinson who does the runs Unbound, the publishing company, and does the Backlisted podcast. He did a good interview with the books, Beatles Books podcast, about anthology, because he was involved in putting that together. So that's worth a listen. But how do you think George comes across kind of in anthology and in those interviews? Because do you think he's up for it, or is he kind of John Cleesing the Monty Python
kind of thing? He kind of looks... I can't tell whether he's like reluctant to be involved or that's just the way that he spoke. And he just such a sort of deadpan... He just had such a sort of deadpan expression. It really is genuinely hard to tell. Like, Paul and Ringo are quite animated people. And so I think if they weren't into it, it would be very, very clear. But with Harrison, he doesn't seem to be into it. But also that is kind of... Even when he's talking about things that he's into...
Yeah.
He also seems to have that sort of slightly, like, I think he was just kind of a deadpan guy.
Yeah. I agree, actually. Yeah.
It's, I think you read so much into him, his kind of performance in that, because he looked like he's staring daggers at Paul every time Paul is speaking, and that he just really can't wait to get the hell out of there. But I think a lot of that is just projecting it onto him.
Yeah. There's so many subplots and so much interest in the relationship between those four. That, I mean, I guess, like, if you've gone deep enough, you will find yourself constantly trying to work out what's really going on at every point.
Yeah. I think that is, especially in those scenes where they're playing together in Paul's studio. They're trying to just sort of, there's obviously someone being like, play, like, have fun, like, be the Beatles.
This is what I can't work out then, because that is also obviously that is very much the vibe of Let It Be, and yet Peter Jackson seems to have found so much footage of them having fun on Let It Be that documentary has now gone from a feature length documentary to like a 6-hour thing. And it's supposed to be a complete inversion of what we all thought was going on when they were making that album.
Well, I've always thought that about the other kind of famous tiffs, like recording the White Album and stuff, where they all apparently fell out. But I don't think you can make an album like the White Album or come back and do Abbey Road after Let It Be if you didn't get on with each other on some level. Like, I read something put an interview with Paul McCartney said, you know, obviously Maxwell's Silver Hammer was the really difficult one, where there were lots of arguments about it because it took them so long to get right. But he was like, it wasn't that bad. You know, it wasn't like, have you ever been in a band kind of thing?
Well, and also, you know, it's like, you know, they're all arguing. Harrison brings in Clapton. Then suddenly they all just behave themselves because there's a stranger there, and McCartney composes the piano intro for While My Guitar Gently Weeps. You're like, I think, you know, also they were boys, like, in retrospect. Yeah. You know, I don't think... Were any of them? They were all just turning 30 when the band ended.
Yeah.
So I mean,
George is 27.
That's right. They're children. You know, they absolutely are children.
Yeah.
I think, like, it's understandable. A lot of the stuff in Let It Be that you remember as being the really kind of explosive stuff is the Teddington Studio.
Yeah.
And that doesn't look fun.
Yeah, right. Like, yeah.
Like, that looks like a kind of shit way to spend a week of, like, pretending to be writing with loads of film cameras. But that's probably the stuff in Savile Row when they're actually being creative and stuff.
Yeah, right.
You can imagine that's more of a sort of fun process. But yeah, as you say, it's 50 years of, like,
just every single piece
combing
of
over every single nasty look, isn't it?
Well, so after the anthology book, then, so did that make? Did he know the records before that, or did he get the anthology?
I knew the records before anthology. Okay, I don't think it's an introduction to the Beatles, that book. No. As much as I love it, I think that's a sort of, that's not a primer. That's something you have to be very invested, even to bother just literally physically picking it up.
Lifting it up, So did you have the Beatles albums in the house then growing up?
There was the Red and the Blue album were definitely in the house when I was growing up. And definitely the Beatles existed as kind of part of the sort of fabric of culture. You know, there's songs that the Beatles... You know, things like Hey Jude and stuff, like, they're just in your life. It's like school hymns or something. Like, it really is just like something that was a part of the fabric of your being. But when I was in my sort of mid-teens, I kind of had a... I'd started listening to the Beatles a bit, but then I had this kind of like sort of Damascene moment of clarity about where I heard Electric Ladyland, the Jimi Hendrix album, and I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard in my entire life. Nice. And that the Hendrix thing is what led me through the All on the Watchtower cover to like obsessively become a Dylan fan. And in that period, I then started digging into the Beatles. And because I had such a kind of superficial understanding of what the band is, if you kind of, and also I think, you know, this, did either of you see Blinded by the Light, the Safraz Mansour thing?
Oh, I haven't seen it.
It's a really nice movie, and it's about him growing up in the 80s, and he's, you know, he's from a South Asian Muslim family, and he gets very into Bruce Springsteen in the 1980s, which obviously people really understand. There is something about, there's a moment in that film where one of the characters says to the protagonist who's based on Safraz Mansour, that's music our dads listen to, and him and his friend who's a Sikh kid both just look at the guy and he just says, not our dads. And you're like, there is something like, my parents like the Beatles and were really, but we're not obsessive fans of them. And mainly the music in my house, mainly when I was growing up, is like 1960s and 70s Bollywood music. So if I'm like nostalgic for any music from my childhood, it's actually those songs. But because of that, you kind of come to Hendrix, Dylan, the Beatles. I came to them with no baggage. No one forced me. There was nobody saying, you must listen to this, you must listen to that. It was something that I came to without any real context or baggage. For me, I have the relationship to them that I think people had at the time with them. I listened to Electric Ladyland and I was like, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. So when I start listening to the Beatles, I'm as close to a blank canvas as it's possible to be if you grew up in England in the 90s.
There is definitely that thing of, like, you know, being a pushy dad saying, oh, listen to this Black Flag album.
And yeah, sure, yeah.
Your kid will just end up getting into the Carpenters or something. Yeah. You know, there is that reaction. So you're right, if you don't have that pushed on you and you don't have that kind of awareness of the baggage.
Then, I just went through it. Like, I can't remember which one the first album was. I have loads of these tapes that I made because, like, all my friends, obviously, their dads all had CDs and stuff. So I would tape all of these things, and the first album I really, really got into was Revolver. I kind of started from the Rubber Soul era, and then kind of hopped around and went back and watched the Hard Day's Night film and bought the Hard Day's Night album. And then, you know, I didn't go, okay, I'm going to start with Please Please Me and work through them all chronologically. Yeah. I bought Sgt. Pepper's and I had tapes that I'd made of that I'd recorded off my friend's CDs of the White Album, Revolver, Abbey Road. And then I can't remember where I now own all of these things, but I definitely at some point someone gave me a tape of Rubber Soul. So I was sort of hopping around all over the Beatles timeline. Revolver was the first one where I was like, this is unbelievable. Like that was the first one that like excited me in as a whole piece. But I also there was a period of about 6 months when I was a teenager where I would just listen to the White Album every day before school. Like, I would listen to... I can't remember how it breaks down side by side, but definitely the run of Blackbird, I'm So Tired, Martha, My Dear, and Happiness is a Warm Gun. I can't remember the order of those. But I think it comes straight after While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah, and definitely. I had a tape of the first disc and the second disc on two separate albums. I kind of thought of them as almost two different albums.
Yeah.
I think, but...
And are you playing, because you're a guitar, you play a bit of guitar as well. Are you learning all those songs at the same time as you're discovering?
Like a lot of people, I can do at 16 or 17, I did a generally quite terrible version of Blackbird. I think that's a pretty... That song has been very poorly treated by terrible by terrible guitar players. And this is not me being accusatory. This is holding my hands up. I am a spokesperson for a generation of people that has mangled Blackbird.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because I did this video, a YouTube video about just playing, because I was teaching guitar last year. And the video with the most hits of how to play Blackbird on YouTube, it tells you how to play it completely wrong.
Right.
Yeah. It's completely wrong. Because it's saying to do all these chords going up and down.
Yeah.
But Blackbird's great because it's got a chromatic bass line going fret by fret.
Yeah, that's the crux. Yeah.
That's the whole point. Yeah. And this guy, he's got a stupid hat. I can't remember his name. But he's telling you to play it by, like, you go up and to this and then you go down. And it's like, that's
no, but
right.
You're supposed to literally just go up one by... I think that's why it's a good beginner's guitar.
But Robin plays it. Robin made me realise I've been playing it wrong for 20 years as well.
Well, no, I'm like, so I've watched videos of Paul McCartney playing it. And he plays it the way it's kind of annotated.
Right.
I think I've just, in them...
But don't you detune the top string to D?
Well, Ian McDonald makes this point that in India... Donovan was telling them about open tunings
things.
And Dear Prudence is in drop D and stuff. Yeah. And I thought there's a way of playing Blackbird with the top E. This is fascinating stuff.
This is very technical. I love it.
There's a way of playing Blackbird with the top, the high E string tuned down to a D that makes it slightly easier. Because you don't have to twist your fingers around like this.
There's one big...
You can keep your basically the same chord shape going up. But I'd watched Paul McCartney play it, and he does play it in all normal tuning, with his fingers twisting around like this. Mm. But, you know, I don't know. But interestingly...
But that sort of four-song run was, like, something that I went back and over again.
Yeah.
Like, Martha, My Dear, Blackbird, and then I absolutely loved I'm So Tired. It's still one of my favourite Beatles songs.
Yeah, it's great.
And... And Happiness is a Warm Gun, which still sounds kind of mad and kind of weird, and there's bits of the Beatles that still feel very subversive and maybe a little underplayed as well.
Totally. I think Happiness is a Warm Gun is the song I play to people who maybe don't know much Beatles, and they say, oh, is this the Beatles? Because when the guitar starts, it sounds like the Smiths or something.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Mm, there's lots it's like of, sort of talking headsy.
Lots of stuff on the White Album. That I think feels like, I think also because there's like there's so many facets to that double album that there's so many bits of it that you can take away. There's like a whole school of sort of sensitive American singer-songwriters, and I think people like Elliott Smith, Amy Mann, that kind of carry the torch of bits of the White Album.
Yes, yeah, I agree.
And at the same time, Revolution Number 9 puts the Beatles in the kind of avant-garde sonic collage experimental thing. That's one of the reasons why I feel like the White Album is the one that I keep on just coming back to again and again and again. And there's bits of it that are utter shit. As there are with all double... There's very few double albums... I think maybe only... I mean, I think probably Electric Ladyland, but Electric Ladyland is a single CD. I'm talking about the double albums that are still...
Yeah.
But, I mean, I would say maybe the Outkast Love Below Speaker Box. But then I think you could make the case that that's actually two solo albums that have basically just been stuck together.
But also the White Album, I think you've got to think of those bits as skits in a way.
Yeah, you know, like right. Yeah.
Hip-hop albums have skits. I think Wild Honey Pie is a bit throwaway and then there's the little voices coming and going, you know.
Obviously but I'd quite happily get rid of the skit. Which is where we kind of... if Room 101 was still a thing, I think skits on hip-hop records...
Oh, yeah, some of them. And let me tell you, some of them have not dated well and some of them dated badly. I'm looking at you, Marshall Mathers. Some of them dated badly as they were happening. Like some of the skits on some of the Eminem records, you're like, I mean, this is just homophobic. This is like, this is like 1970s Bernard Manning routine.
I know. Doggy Style, though, that's got some great skits.
Doggy Style's got some great skits.
Yeah, but you sort of chuckle the first time and then a little, you know, the second time and then by the 100th time.
Very quotable, yeah. though.
Even like, the one on Blonde where there's like a sort of phone message from Frank Ocean's mum about like smoking
yeah,
drugs.
Smoking
or
yeah,
like, once you've heard that, you know, 50 times, it's kind of done all it's going to do for you.
What's the Beatles thing on Blonde as well? There's a Beatles connection.
White
Blonde,
Ferrari is...
White Ferrari is Here, There and Everywhere.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. he's kind of used the melody of Here, There and Everywhere and kind of changed the speed of it all and made a kind of different song out of it, which is great.
Yeah. It's quite a good, like, hands up, because that would have cost him a lot of money and he probably could have got away with that.
Yeah, it is. I guess the fact that that's where you get into the realm of homage, because if you immediately come out of the gate copping to it...
Yeah.
You know, that's... I think that's fine. That's homage. But, I mean, if we start getting into that terrain, Noel Gallagher has no money.
Yeah.
Like, Noel Gallagher is bankrupt if we go too far into it.
He even started ripping off the Ruttles.
Yeah. Do you see that thing that happened the other week? Because, you know, Olivia Rodrigo, she's, like a bunch of people said, you know, there was an article saying, oh, she's ripped off this person, that person.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And Elvis Costello replied to the tweet saying, yeah, well, that's just how rock works, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean...
It's really
oh, yeah, because there's a bit of, like, Pump It Up, which is, like, sort of head that he alluded to in one of her songs.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. I mean...
Yeah. I mean, that is kind of... Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Beatles... But, I mean, they were also sort of signing their crime, as it were. Because if you look at the stuff that they cover... you know, especially with the early albums, where you've got the covers sat side by side with the originals... You know, you can. They're very much showing they're working. You know, they're covering Chuck Berry. They're covering. You know, there's Little Richard covers, and then they're also covering. Motown songs. You know, there's. They do a. You Really Got a Hold on Me, the Smokey Robinson song, and they do like. And so they're really like signposting. This is what the stuff that we are listening to, and what the original songs you were hearing is like what happens if kids from Liverpool get saturated in early rock and roll and R&B and bits of rockabilly, and then also start incorporating Motown and the like the harmonies that are in lots of those early Motown songs. They were very much sort of signposting how their thinking was working. And then it becomes more opaque as the covers sort of disappear. You know, there's no Dylan cover. There's not a...
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Dylan cover on those early Beatles albums, but you can definitely hear, if you listen to everything chronologically, you're like, and they just got a Bob Dylan album. You know, around Beatles for Sale, you go, and there it is.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's weird that they sort of stopped covering people at that time. Quite lucky that, really, because
no
one wants to hear the Beatles do Blowing in the Wind on Rubber Soul.
In the folk scene, well, I suppose this is happening a little bit later, but I've just been listening to, actually, the Richard Thompson autobiography, Beeswing, and he talks a lot about how they were just desperate to get new Dylan songs to cover. And it was like they were trying to find the most obscure Dylan song they could cover. And the Beatles, because they were obviously a few years before that, and by the obviously writing their own songs, they didn't have that kind of relationship with Dylan. It was more of a kind of, appeared in their own songs, as it were.
Yeah. I suppose they wouldn't have offered much more to the songs in a way that, like, Hendrix obviously you think of All Along the Watchtower, but he did load of amazing Dylan covers, like
Please Crawl Out Your Window is so good.
Absolutely incredible. I mean, there's a few people that I feel like, I really feel Hendrix particularly, and Nina Simone, I think, who there's a couple of her versions of Dylan songs sort of get under the skin of the songs in ways that nobody else does, because Hendrix did All on the Watchtower, Drifter's Escape, which is also on John Wesley Harding, and then Can You Please Crawl Out Your Window, which was just a single that he put out in the mid-60s, and he seems to just have an understanding of how those songs work. Hendrix also, the Drifter's Escape, I think, is on the BBC Sessions, where Hendrix also does an absolutely hell-raising day tripper. Like, it's like, it's properly, I mean, it's taking what that song is signposting musically and updating it however many three or four years into where guitar music had got to. You know, the riff for Day Tripper is a sort of, you know, is a classic blues rock thing. What Hendrix then does is go, this is what we're doing with that style of music now. And just absolutely tears into it. The solo in that cover of Day Tripper is incredible. Got a good reason for taking the easy way out. Got a good reason for taking the easy way out now. It was a day tripper, a way tripper, a way tripper. So long, find out, I'll find out. He plays a bit of I Want to Tell You is in there as well, but they don't play the whole thing, annoyingly. He just plays a bit of I Want to Tell You, the riff of it, in there.
And then he does Sunshine of Your Love, doesn't he? And he cuts into...
That's the Lulu Show performance,
Where he does a little bit of... Down, you know, between the riffs. It's very very clever. I've got the Hendrix... We used to have the Hendrix BBC sessions. And am I right in thinking, is like Alan Freeman is on introducing them?
Yeah, there's loads of bits.
I like the idea that he was just on the tape and they couldn't get rid of Fluff. That's great.
There's also a really amazing Radio 1 jingle, which is such a missed opportunity that Radio 1 never used it.
Radio 1, you stole my gal, but I love you just the same.
Incredible. So what was, were you a sort of Britpop man then growing up, Nish, or were you slightly young for Britpop? Did you get the second wave of the Beatles?
The first albums that I bought were The Great Escape, The Blur, Great Escape, and What's the Story, Morning Glory. And I, you know, I quite liked that stuff. I never wholeheartedly embraced it in a way. Maybe I was a little bit young. I was probably about 9 or 10 when a lot of that stuff was happening. So maybe I was a little bit young for that. I was very into the Fugees and Lauryn Hill. And definitely, the more I think about it, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill was the first time I heard an album that was designed to be an album. And the first time I was conscious that I was listening to something that somebody hadn't just mashed, hadn't just written 10 songs and then just jammed it all together. There was a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the skits, which is probably not the right word for those, were actually sort of, there was like some plot and theme and tone that was being drawn out. And then I go down this kind of 1960s and 70s rabbit hole and start listening to, you know, What's Going On and all the early 70s Stevie Wonder albums where Motown have kind of lost control of him and Marvin Gaye. A lot of like Nina Simone stuff. And then lots of kind of 60s blues rock, sort of Hendrix offshoots. And then just, that was when the kind of deep study of the Beatles began for me. And, you know, I was all over Revolver. I really liked Dylan. And so I think that's part of the reason why I didn't take to Beatles for Sale as much. Because as a big Dylan fan, Beatles for Sale, lots of it felt like somebody doing a sort of pastiche.
Can be a bit Dylan-like.
But I mean, the moments where, there are moments where, I mean, on Help, like, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away definitely feels like a really successful version of the Beatles kind of doing Dylan in inverted commas. And there's lots of that that I absolutely love. But yes, then I would have seen A Hard Day's Night and And then, yeah, and you know, the mythology runs deep. If you want to, if you really want to get into it and you really want to start reading about why people thought Paul McCartney was dead, if you really want to start, like, reading about the run on the second side of Abbey Road and the kind of conception of all of that stuff, you really can go for it. I mean, the second half of Abbey Road is just absolutely incredible. The transition from politics... The thing that I often play to people to go... there's much more to the Beatles than you know, is the run from Polythene Pam into She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. Because, like, the build-up of that, where the kind of drums are sort of kicking in really hard, and he shouts, "Oh, look out!" And then it just drops straight into She Came In Through the Bathroom Window. It's just still incredible and still exciting. And the other thing I always do is play Her Majesty, because that is, to me, the quintessential... Beatles, what made the Beatles specifically, I think what keeps them engaged is that there is a kind of sense of humour and a sense of mischief and a sense of fun. So that even when they've kind of, you know, composed this thing that has this kind of arcing structure and all of these songs run into each other, and then they do the end, which is a curtain call for the entire band. You know, the three guitarists play a guitar solo, Ringo plays a drum solo, and then they have this, like, line that they think sums up the entire philosophy of the Beatles, and in the end, the love you make is equal to the love you take. And you know, they've drawn a line under it, and then they have to just... There's just, like, this weird 20-second song about wanting to fuck the Queen. and it's like, you know, it's like somebody just, like, deliberately just smearing, like, just like throwing a weird, you know, it's like you paint a masterpiece and then just for no reason you just draw small cock and balls in the corner. Like, and it, that for me is what is fun about the Beatles, is that there's a sense of play that runs through all of their work. And that sense of play and that sense of fun and that sense of mischief is the thing that I find often gets drowned out in the way that the Beatles are written about and spoken
about. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. I guess, they're never really earnest. And that moment is one where you think, this is a little bit, you know, out, and then, it's the perfect little wink as a coda at the end.
Isn't it great the way it just ends so quickly?
With
the and needle lifting.
That's the other thing, is like, that song doesn't even finish properly.
Yeah. But then it's sort of a callback to the way I Want You, She's So Heavy ends. Because that just ends with the needle lifting up. And that's such a great ending for that song. And I don't know, it's weird that Abbey Road is such a polished album, and both sides end in that sudden way.
Yeah, that's really right. Interesting. Yeah. I think something about that, the sort of, the need to constantly move away from it being a completely polished, finished. Because I think that might feel quite sterile, like in a way that it could feel quite sterile, like Abbey Road, because it's so, you know, there's so much care and attention in that run.
We've talked a lot with people on this podcast about their journey with sort of favourite Beatles. But did you go through phases of identifying with a particular member of the band?
Well, I think when you're sort of 15, 16-year-old boy, the Lennon stuff is the stuff that really, you know, it really resonates with you. But obviously, one of the things that I always felt was that I felt very protective of Paul McCartney, which is a very funny thing to feel protective of a billionaire. But I always felt very protective of Paul McCartney because obviously he sort of talked about, like, he was, you know, like, basically like he was writing like advert jingles. But actually, you know, he was the one living in London. He was the one hanging out with, or, you know, he was the one doing the tape loops on Tomorrow Never Knows, the rewound guitars. That's all him. Because he was living in St. John's Wood and, you know, rubbing shoulders with the sort of mad avant-garde artists.
Well, that's the funny thing about Anthology, isn't it? And Carnival of Light, you know that story where he was desperate for Carnival of Light to be put on Anthology because it would, like, prove that he was the one who did the kind of big avant-garde thing first before Revolution Number 9.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, so, yeah.
I mean, it is sort of. I will always find it funny when Paul McCartney is asked to name his favourite songs, and he will include a Beatles song. That to me is always like, will always make me laugh. Yeah. But yeah, I definitely went through a phase of. I remember really feeling connected to George because he loved India, and I was like, respect. Mm. Love that. You know, love that. And also, like, George Harrison, you know, there's often these conversations about cultural appropriation, right, you know, these contemporary conversations about cultural appropriation. But the thing about George Harrison particularly is that, you know, he did it. He went and studied with Ravi Shankar, and he, you know, he really lived that life and really absorbed and learned and was a diligent student of Indian classical music.
And what did your parents, I mean, you talked about growing up listening to Bollywood records. Did your parents, what did they make of that kind of Indian crossover in the Beatles music?
They thought it was absolutely cool. Right. They loved it. They loved the idea that George Harrison, they were always like, George is the best one because he loves India. And they loved it. They absolutely loved the idea that they had gone, you know, that he had, I think particularly because, like, obviously Ravi Shankar is like, you know, such a significant cultural figure in India.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact that he, you know, had personally taught George how to play the sitar, like all that stuff, they thought it was very exciting.
Yeah.
And I think definitely with Harrison, once you start playing the guitar and you start, you know, George Harrison is an exceptional guitar player and is quite a sort of unheralded part of the kind of Beatles work is a lot of the skilled instrumentation. You know, McCartney is an excellent guitar player. Mm. And, you know, Lennon's guitar playing on Get Back is brilliant.
Yeah.
But I always think of, the guitar solo on Let It Be, because I think that is a really beautiful piece of music and it's a really beautiful composition, and there's not a lot of, he's not like a flair player, you know, he's not bending the notes or doing like these like crazy fast playing solos, but he has an incredible sense of a melodic guitar solo.
Yeah. And what I think as well, Free as a Bird, solo on
Free as a Bird.
Yeah, yeah,
love
really
that. Good.
Yeah, it's really
it's
good.
It's just so precise. And as you say, very melodic and just,
his
great
slide playing in particular in the sort of, because he only really started playing slide at, like, very end of the sort of 60s, and then by 1972 he's incredible, like standard slide player, and especially stuff where his intonation while playing slide and especially double tracking over himself is up there with the best ever put on record. It's amazing. Unbelievable.
It's amazing. And also, you know, lots of All Things Must Pass is an amazing, it's an incredible album. Yeah, and, you know, I think you could reasonably make the case that What Is Life is the best Beatles solo song. I think it's an extraordinary song. And even the way that the two guitar parts sort of interlock in that song is so brilliant and so smart. But the sort of euphoric rush of that song is so wonderful, and the horn parts, and that would be my
I always think
favorite.
What Is Life is about to go into One Fine Day.
Do you
have that song? I think that was at the back of his mind, maybe.
It definitely has
you know, it almost goes.
Even the production has the kind of almost like Phil Spector-y sort of
definitely
feel
yeah.
to it, like a kind of a sort of wall of sound vibe to it.
I always think with the Indian stuff with the Beatles, like, A, as you say, it was so, George Harrison really meant it.
Yeah.
He got so immersed in it. And also the way it sounds in Beatles records, like in Revolver, I just love how, you know, at the end of I'm Only Sleeping, there's that little bit burst of it. It's almost like a hint of what's to come. And then in Sergeant Pepper, the way that Eastern instruments, for want of a better word, and Western instruments kind of talk to each other.
Yeah, yeah.
The beautiful arrangements of the kind of cellos dipping and diving.
Yeah.
And it's so well done. And I think there is an argument about cultural appropriation, but I think it's more to do with a band. I mean, much as I love them, like a band like Incredible String Band,
right?
Where
yeah,
they wrote
yeah.
these great songs and then just chuck a sitar on it.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's
yeah.
just like it's dated. It sounds makes it sound so dated now. I
yeah,
think.
Yeah.
I mean, much as I absolutely love that band and their fantastic songs, but that I think that's where it's just a bit like plonk a bit of.
Yeah, yeah,
Indian music on to give it a spirituality thing, yeah. You know?
Don't go and listen to Kula Shaker.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. Kula Shaker is the one that I always think about.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I often think like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones to an extent dodge a lot of accusation about cultural appropriation because, I mean, especially in the case of the Stones, they when they got to America, they couldn't believe that Muddy Waters wasn't the most famous man in America,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
they had all those guys open for them, you know? And even when they made when Scorsese made the documentary about 10, 12 years ago, you know, one of the guests they bring out is Buddy Guy. Mm. And, you know, I think the Beatles and the Stones particularly were very good at acknowledging the, you know, were good at acknowledging the roots that they came from. And, you know, they yeah. took so much from Black American music. Mm. And it's to their credit that they then, having recognised that, you know, there's this thing in the Ron Howard documentary where they sort of refuse to play segregated rooms. Mm. Mm. And, you know, that is an example of them correctly not only observing, you know, basic human right and observing a principle of racial justice, but also correctly acknowledging that without African American music, there is no Beatles. And you know, John Lennon learned to sing literally just copying Little Richard. You know that. Mm. You know that those. That, but those were bands that really did sort of acknowledge their roots and didn't try and distance themselves from Black culture when they were presented with the opportunity to do so.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I like the Ron Howard documentary.
I do as well. Like, yeah, I
think that stuff of them like being a touring band is really interesting, and you know, like learning their trade in Hamburg and that sort of era is very interesting. Because particularly when I was a kid, for me, what I was drawn to was the kind of Revolver. You know, that feels like the sort of music nerd period of the Beatles to get into, and it feels like that is the period, you know, that's the period of deep study. What were they doing when they did Revolver? The, you know, the build up of Sgt. Pepper's and the kind of concept behind it.
Well, I think the Ron Howard film does a good job at just showing how like totally unprecedented it was, kind of socially, culturally. It's like literally do not know how to manage that many people.
Yeah,
you know, and so like that's kind of, and you know, five or 10 years later, they could have put on much bigger concerts that made sense, you know. But in the history of, you know, in the history of public address systems, it's very
because they were like, they were basically playing their instruments into a loudspeaker.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at football, at, you know, like baseball stadiums.
Yeah, like, I love that one as well. Where like Ringo's drum kit's facing the wrong way, so when they come on stage, they have to turn it around. That's so good. And Ringo's absolutely hammering it. Like what he's on, he's just. Maybe he probably can't hear himself. But
well, that's
just
the thing.
Like,
I think he's just trying to establish any sort of like beat, isn't he?
But he looks like he's playing in Minor Threat or something. He's just
even the vocals of that, it's, you know, like, it sounds like a fucking Iggy Pop record at points.
Yeah,
the live performances, and you're like, because they're sort of like screaming, you know, I think they were like literally trying to shout to the audience.
Mm.
And so it does create this like really weirdly punky sounding performances,
except they're all perfectly in tune, which
exactly.
I do not understand.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah.
I just think it looks absolutely awful going to one of those gigs.
Yeah, it does.
They
it
play
does
for 20
chaos.
Minutes, so you can't hear anything. It sounds like shit, and it's just, you know, looks like an absolute nightmare. So I suppose I don't really. I like the first half an hour of that documentary a lot, but I guess like. Yeah, I completely empathise with them being like, enough's enough. This
yeah,
is just
right.
insane.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, but also it's always worth the rate of the speed of change.
Mm.
You know, the speed from which they're like, they go from, I want to hold your hand, to turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. That's like, that's what, 3-4 years?
It's dizzying, isn't it? And I think we're so used to that kind of, it's very much a sort of thing that gets tweeted around now. Like someone said the other day, we're now further away from the Blur's Universal video than the Universal was away from Clockwork Orange or something like that. But then we're so used to kind of things like that. And it's sort of like the Beatles kind of embody that weird, you know, whatever happened to time in the 60s. It's just something weird happened to time. I think we can all agree something weird happened to time in terms of how accelerated culture was moving.
It just, a lot of those people, you know, the sort of the Dylans, the Hendrixes. I mean, Hendrix is such an absurdly short period of time because the whole recording career is barely 4 years. And the whole period of time is, but you know, even like some of those Motown artists, like if you listen to like a Marvin Gaye best of, is a journey, man.
That is a
journey from like, he looks like Nat King Cole, like in some of the like early stuff, and he's like sort of smooth crooning, and even like the more sort of up-tempo things are like, I'm just a stubborn kind of fellow. And then just suddenly disc two, he's like stoned hippie, and they're just writing the most like
perverse liner notes,
and they're just like, let's get on. He's just like, he's gone from like, you know, like wink wink nudge nudge to being like, let's have sex right now. Let's just have sex and just fully have sex. But to be clear, only if you're into it. I will require your consent. Like, that's the great thing about Let's Get It On. Let's Get It On as a song, absolutely, it survives the Me Too era. Because Let's Get It On, the whole premise of Let's Get It On is, let's absolutely fuck as long as you're cool with it. And if you're not, let's not.
There's a great bit, I can't remember, I think it's in a Nicholson Baker book, where he says the first kind of moan of Let's Get It On is like 8 notes or something. It's so good, because it just goes... it's great. It's so, what an instrument. I can't remember if I told this story before, but my mum is really into soul music, and one Christmas I got her a Marvin Gaye CD, and you can guess which one it was. I got Let's Get It On. The liner notes really made for interesting reading on Christmas Day morning. Oh my God, I'm actually blushing thinking about that.
But that's why in some ways, I mean, I don't think that you could possibly say that it holds up as well as some of the later albums, but in some ways, like, Help is sort of one of the most interesting Beatles albums, or just that middle period, like Help, Rubber Soul, where you're catching them right in the middle.
Yeah.
And the sort of variety of songs, you know, even the song Help is such an interesting encapsulation of them kind of half in transition, because the actual melody and construction is very much, you know, it sounds like the songs that they were writing at the time, but the lyrics are about Lennon sort of in an existential tailspin. And it's those kind of moments are really fascinating when you catch, when you see somebody, when you catch the Beatles kind of on the hoof, like it mid transformation.
That was a great point. It might have been Joel Morris, so the comedy writer, said about The Word by the Beatles is such a great song because it's the first time they use the word love kind of conceptually. Which is such a good point.
That's such an interesting thing, because it isn't,
it wasn't She Loves You or,
But that's why I think, like, for an album that at the time, at the time I was listening to a lot of the album, something like Help was something I was like, yeah, okay, I get it. But now, obviously, once you have more of a sense of the shape of the career, it is really interesting to, like, sort of catch them in mid step.
There's so much of that great stuff in the first anthologies as well, where it's basically in chronological order, but then there's one leap where you're like, oh my God, like what happened here? Where you're just suddenly like, you know, whatever it is, they're just trying one extra thing and it's like leave everyone else in the dust.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Even the much maligned by me album Beatles for Sale,
Yeah.
Having an album now that you sort of, now when you listen to it, you understand where it exists in that particular point in the cycle. An album that has 8 days a week and I'm a loser on it.
Yeah.
That is a really interesting thing. Like, you know, it's interesting.
Well, we're big fans of Beatles for Sale. I think we talked about it with relatively not
Matthew
minority,
Crosby,
but...
I think. And I think we were talking about how it just sounds great because it sounds kind of really spontaneous. It does tail off a bit at the end.
Yeah.
But the covers are brilliant. And I particularly love the Buddy Holly cover.
Oh, it's yeah, really, that's a really beautiful. Good cover, yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
But it's interesting kind of catching them, you know, catching them on the half step.
Yes, yeah, definitely. There's definitely this sense that Lennon, and, you know, when you listen to the Rubber Soul outtakes and they're so stoned and being hilarious and everything, and that's not quite there in the music yet, but then it's coming through, and then by the time you get to Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour, it's fully there, kind of, that crossover's happened, you know.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
It's a lovely period.
The thing that I think is so odd is Eleanor Rigby. I still don't think... I don't think even with people who talk constantly about the Beatles talk enough about how fucking weird Eleanor Rigby is.
Yeah, totally.
It's this really bleak story about a sad person who just dies and their life means nothing. And, like, you know, and it's like... It's kind of thrilling, and the fact that it's just like backed by a sort of string quartet, and you know, even the rhythms, like George Martin was trying to bring, there's like Eastern rhythms in the way the rhythmic arrangement of Eleanor Rigby, and the whole thing sounds so strange. Wiping his hands as he walks from the grave, no one was saved. It's like, that's fucking insane.
Well, yeah, if you think about it as well, the fact that that was the single, that would have been the biggest,
yeah,
you know, as a single. That was the biggest departure in their whole career, isn't it? I remember, you know, used to listen to Classic Gold on the way to school.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the oldie stations, and a DJ playing Eleanor Rigby, and said, "God, we really thought they'd gone mad when they released that one." But it's weird because it's not, you know, it's not Strawberry Fields or Penny Lane or Sergeant. It's like Eleanor Rigby is the first one where it's like I think you're absolutely right.
And I mean, Strawberry Fields still sounds strange and still sounds incredible. Yeah. And one of my favourite things about part of the thing that I talked a lot about when Jeff Lloyd asked me about the anthology, one of the biggest things I talked about was the outtakes of Strawberry Fields and hearing that come together. And then I don't know whether you guys... Oh, of course you guys have got this, but I don't know why I assumed you wouldn't have got it. But the Love album, the weird Cirque du Soleil tie-in album.
I quite like it. I love it.
Like, I really, really love it. And one of the things that I love is that they take the horns from Savoy Truffle, I think, and put them on Drive My Car and turn Drive My Car into what it is, which is a Motown pastiche. Baby, you can drive my car. Yes, I'm gonna be a star. Baby, you can drive my car. And maybe I love you. Beep, 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 yeah.
Well, the Eleanor Rigby section is amazing.
So. Yeah, but and I also think that what they do with Strawberry Fields, where they edit together the kind of three outtakes. So you start with Lennon playing solo guitar, and then you have this first phase of the studio recording, and then it builds into the final version. I think is genuinely extraordinary. I think it's absolutely brilliant, and it really takes you on the journey of that song.
Yeah.
That ends up with, you know, because the sort of sonic collage that's going on in Strawberry Fields is absolutely incredible.
But there's another... it's got the bit from Piggies.
Yeah, from Piggies.
And it works really well. Yeah, I love it.
It's really good.
I don't remember that. I think I'd block that out of my mind.
I like Love. I thought it was great.
I like Love. I hate Piggies.
Oh, yeah. Fucking Piggies, man. Fucking Piggies. God bless anyone who enjoys that song, but I cannot get on board with it.
Tell you what I like about Piggies is that weird string bit at the end. It's great.
It's quite frightening. That
It's not for me, thank you.
Yeah, it's a note from me.
But yeah, I love the fact that they compress it, because you sort of by the time you hear Strawberry Fields, there's so much going on. You know, like the cello part in Strawberry Fields is unreal, and then you've got the sort of mellotron, and then it's all sort of built up into this crazy thing, and it's so great to hear how it builds up and how they start from the germ of the song, and then it, you know, by the end it becomes this kind of like, you know, I get, it's trying to chart his whatever, he's like, he's taken acid and he's dropped back through a hole into his childhood.
Yeah, so I love that you can hear the frustration in those demos as well, and trying to sort of work it out, and there's that bit where you can, he's getting really angry with himself, and then he tries like changing the sort of strum patterns and stuff. It's a very good for anyone like me who tends to like rip up 90% of what they write songwriting wise immediately. It's worth persevering with a sort of a mediocre idea.
I also really love the A Day in the Life outtakes for the same thing, like the same principle, where they're like, he's talking about where he wants the mic in the piano, and they're talking about that specific sound, and then he, I think he says something like Sugar Plum Fairy, Fairy. And that's, he's trying to give them like the sense of what the rhythm of the song is going to be.
I loved them try when they didn't know how to end Day in the Life and just tried humming. Like, you just imagine them looking at each other and go, no, I don't think that's it.
I'm going to go a different direction with this one.
That's great.
So that was Nish Kumar with a fabulous personal Beatles.
Yes, indeed. I really enjoyed that chat. Love the chat about Revolver. And I think I'm really kind of fascinated with the, you know, the American release of Revolver, which we've mentioned a few times. You know, it doesn't have I'm Only Sleeping on it.
What a bizarre track to...
We talked in the Patreon episode about how fixing a hole... it's kind of the signature song for Sgt. Pepper. I always think I'm Only Sleeping is the kind of signature song of Revolver. It seems to sum up the mood of it somehow, or the feel somehow. Yeah. I don't know why.
And it definitely couldn't exist on any other album.
Exactly, and it's such a progression from the, you know, the guitar-led ones of Rubber Soul. But yeah. I mean, I do like that point I made about I'm Only Sleeping ends with a backwards guitar, and it does seem to kind of preempt the kind of Indian influence...
For sure.
Love you too and everything. But yeah, it was a very good chat.
Yeah. I've never mentioned it on the podcast before, but my problem with that song is when I first heard it...
You heard the Vines cover?
The Suggs version from the early 90s.
Yeah, so, yeah. Big Beatles fan.
Yeah. I had that on CD for some reason. That was great. If you listen to the normal version, there's an extended version of that
Not
on
of I'm
Patreon.
Only Sleeping.
Not of Suggs' version of I'm Only Sleeping. No one wants that. But of more with Nish. So you can go to patreon.com/your own personal Beatles and join some of the lovely people that joined the Patreon this week, who including... legends like Jake Brown, Jimmy D, Ted Tooley, Benedict Cordy, Emily Greenaway, just Tom, Christian
Mitri. Tom from MySpace.
That's Tom, and he didn't give another name. Fair enough. Actually, we've got a lot of Toms, of Toms, and quite a few Charlies and Charleses. Nice. So we've got Charles Olney and Charlie L. Wes. I hope I pronounced that right. But yeah, they've all joined in the last week. Why don't you do it too?
If you want.
If you want. Don't, if you don't want, or if you can't afford it, we understand. You know, but it's a bit of fun. So we'll be back next week with Matthew Crosby.
Yes.
From Pappies and the Radio.
Yeah.
With a brilliant chat that's quite heavy on things like Yellow Submarine, the film, which is relatively unmined territory for us. And we talk a lot about Beatles for Sale.
Yeah, this was the big kind of defence of Beatles for Sale one, where I kind of, before we recorded it, I had a big, big listening splurge where I listened to it a lot and kind of really reconnected with it. So it was a really fun one to record.
Yeah, for sure. And if you're a Patreon subscriber, you get a little treat of me attempting to sing the opening phrase from Mr. Moonlight.
Oh, yeah. And that was belting.
See how that goes.
He stood so far away from the mic, innit? Yeah,
well, you have to do it very loud. Mm. It's a top B-flat. Probably John Lennon's only B-flat, I'd wager.
Really?
Yeah, might well be.
It's what I mean, did he do a B?
No, I don't think so. He's not usually in that kind of range.
I see what you mean.
B-flat, that's good. It's good, high tenor, B-flat.
What's Paul's highest note?
Oh, right up there, probably high, maybe high C's, high D's.
Really?
I think the highest Paul one I know is it. Maybe I'm Amazed, I think there's a high D in there.
Oh, yeah. Not that bit.
It's the Maybe I'm Amazed.
Oh, yeah.
I'm the only one that's in the middle or something. But yeah, all that to look forward to. And more.
Cheers, bye.
Your Own Personal Beatles is presented by Jack Pelling and Robin Allender. The podcast artwork is done by Morgan Ritchie. It's produced by me, Jack Pelling, and is a Homespun Sounds production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.